Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Newcastle County is taking an initial look at the possibility of relocating residents of two neighborhoods along Route 9 in response to ongoing environmental issues there.
We've been trying to move for a long time, but most of us cannot afford to just up and leave. And it wouldn't be fair to sell a house to somebody knowing that this is contaminated land.
Our Sophia Schmidt reports on a survey of Eden Park and Hamilton Park to gauge their thoughts on relocation. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from a local doctor on the front lines of Delaware's battle against the opioid crisis. And we have new editions of Arts Playlist and Enlighten Me. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Newcastle County has finished surveying residents of two communities along Route 9 about environmental conditions in their neighborhoods and whether they might ultimately want to relocate if given the opportunity. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt has the story.
Hamilton Park and Eden Park have faced more than a few environmental issues over the years, enough to make a step as radical as relocation worth entertaining. Carrie Casey manages community development and housing for Newcastle County. She says the county's goals for a recent survey are to gauge residents' perception of the neighborhood's environmental issues, their knowledge of past mobilization efforts,
and then to see where the community is on relocation and or cleaning up or doing other things around them so that they are in a good, you know, good, healthy place to live.
Hamilton Park and Eden Park sit off Route 9 just south of Wilmington city limits. They're majority African-American communities with median household income around $32,000, according to the Wilmington Area Planning Council's mapping analysis of available demographic data. They're nestled between companies like Keene Compressed Gas, Bruce Industrial, and Diamond Materials, a paving and concrete constructor whose huge uncovered mounds of materials tower over Route 9. The neighborhoods are also located near the Halby Superfund site, where a chemical manufacturing plant once stood. Primary contaminant concerns at the site are arsenic and carbon disulfide, but according to the EPA, human exposure and groundwater migration there are under control. Residents also complain of airborne dust from nearby industry and emissions from the many trucks that drive through on their routes and to and from the port. Issues like these led some in the community to raise the idea of relocation. It was part of a 2004 lawsuit in which more than 250 Eden and Hamilton Park residents filed against roughly 30 local companies, such as Clean Earth of Newcastle, Wilmington Chemical Corporation, and Grego and Ferreira. The relief sought by the plaintiffs included fair value for their homes.
We sued that either you move your industries or move us.
That's Pastor Lewis McDuffie. He's president of the Hamilton Park Eden Park Civic Association and a longtime community leader on environmental issues. McDuffie says most plaintiffs received a check for property damages, but a buyout did not occur because the neighborhood didn't achieve the required consensus. Marcia Mason has lived in Eden Park her whole life. She says for the last 15 years, she hasn't wanted to.
Because we've been trying to move for a long time, but most of us cannot afford to just up and leave. And it wouldn't be fair to sell a house to somebody knowing that this is contaminated land.
Mason's biggest concern with the environment in Eden Park is health.
You have the allergy problem, the depression. With my father, he had a massive heart attack, and my mom got cancer. I had a heart attack and cancer.
Irvin Whitehurst grew up in Hamilton Park.
When you look at the state of Delaware and see how the housing development is set up, mostly out in the rural areas, you don't see no industrial park like this where people have to live the way we live, okay? Put our health at risk.
Bill Switek with the Wilmington Area Planning Council calls the area around Eden Park and Hamilton Park an example of bad zoning.
You have residential communities that are located way too close to industrial. In the case of Hamilton Park, in the case of Eden Park, they're completely surrounded by industrial land.
And he says the result is the public health concerns residents face today.
Concerns about dust that DENREC has detected in high levels, concerns about the truck traffic, all kind of tie back to the way that the land was zoned.
In 2015, Newcastle County tasked the Wilmington Area Planning Council, or WILMAPCO, with preparing a transportation and land use plan for the Route 9 corridor. One of the plan's main recommendations is that incompatible uses, like residential and heavy industry, be separated wherever possible along the corridor. It recommends the county look into the possibility of relocating residents of Eden and Hamilton Park and letting that land develop with more business or industry. Switek says the idea of relocation came from discussions with residents.
In terms of the people that we have talked to as part of the plan, I would say that the vast majority of them from those neighborhoods were interested in it. So it's not something where we're trying to force this on the community. It's really something where we're trying to support the community in their efforts to have a better life.
Last year, Newcastle County government began to act on WMAPCO's recommendations. The county hired a third party to conduct the census-style community survey on whether residents want to relocate or would prefer another solution. Dr. Victor Perez is a professor of sociology at the University of Delaware with specializations in environmental justice, health and illness, and the sociology of risk.
There's a history of mobilization around these issues in these communities. There's currently ongoing soil remediation in Hamilton Park. There was also an air quality study in Eden Park that was catalyzed by resident concerns over fugitive dust and truck emissions.
He developed the survey with the help of community members over several months and put it in the field early this summer.
Providing essentially a platform for an objective assessment of how people feel about these issues today.
The survey was anonymous and voluntary. Residents were compensated $10 for their time. Relocation was just a portion of the survey. It also asked about health, perceptions of pollution, and residents' feelings on other hypothetical changes in the area, like revitalization, rezoning, or environmental regulation. But the survey did ask how likely residents would be to relocate if given certain financial assistance or the value of a home in a similar area. It asked about other barriers to moving too, like age or social ties. Surveyors made clear to residents there is currently no funding available for relocation. Residents could also answer that they think there are no environmental issues in their neighborhood. Carrie Casey with Newcastle County says the county has not made any decisions about what might happen if survey results say the community is overwhelmingly in favor of relocation. Nor has the county done any calculations about what relocation might cost or studied what fair relocation might look like. She says the county doesn't even have a plan for next steps after survey data is analyzed.
The first key thing for us is seeing what the community really feels about this.
Casey says the county intends to involve the community in any decision-making processes, and the community will be the first to see results of the survey. Joe Day manages code enforcement for the county. He says no other stakeholders have been consulted about relocation so far, but if the survey finds the community wants relocation, other partners would likely be brought in.
With DENREC or with DelDOT or the Port of Wilmington or maybe federal grants, I think there's a lot of other factors, but I think we need to get the results of the survey before we even start investigating those other factors.
Jim Smith with the County Land Use Department adds private partners could be engaged. He points out that with 198 inhabited parcels among the two communities, lots of uncertainty remains.
You're dealing with two different communities with a lot of families inside of each one. We have recommendations that were laid out from a big group consensus, but now we have to see what, you drill down to the individual families, what it is that they really want and need.
County officials stress the survey is not leading for or against relocation, and they admit relocation would be a big challenge for the county. Joe Day.
We're going to work as hard as we can to meet the community's expectations. By no means am I, would we guarantee that that's going to happen? But if that's what the community wants, we are here to work for the community, and we're going to do everything in our power to actually make this happen.
Perez's team finished collecting survey data at the end of August. Perez sees his survey as just the first small piece of research that needs to be done. He notes there are a few precedents to follow.
The idea of relocation predicated on perceptions of environmental burdens, embodied experiences with environmental burdens, lived experiences with environmental burdens, is relatively novel.
But at this point, residents are eager to have answers. Marcia Mason says the community is tired of fighting and worries county government won't move quickly enough.
If they have it their way, they'll probably be waiting for another 15 years.
Hamilton Park's Whitehurst.
They need to go ahead and say what they're going to do for us so we'll know what we need to do.
Perez says initial data analysis could be finished by the end of the month. Only then may the county decide what comes next. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. Up next, Delaware continues to seek ways to battle the impact the opioid crisis has in the first state. Our Nick Shalino talks to one local doctor working on the front lines to shape the state's response to opioid addiction. That interview is coming up next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Dr. Sandra Gibney works in the emergency department at St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington. She's also a member of Delaware's Behavioral Health Consortium, led by Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long. Among other things, that group is charged with combating the state's opioid crisis. It's made wide-ranging recommendations to Governor John Carney, helped pass overdose legislation, and gone out into communities to pass out Narcan, the opioid overdose antidote. Gibney sat down this week with Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino to discuss her role in the consortium connecting people with substance abuse disorder to treatment.
We are going to do this until we fix this, you know. And I don't know it's going to be a complete fix, but God bless. It's got to do better than we're doing right now, you know.
Yeah. Department of Health and Social Services just announced that last month, 39 people statewide passed away from overdoses, and that's the highest month since they've been keeping track. They started in 2013. You've talked about some of the boots on the ground stuff. Your other role on the Behavioral Health Consortium is to try to connect people with treatment. With the passage of some laws, like the governor just signed the overdose system of care bill, what is that going to open up and allow for the state to do in regards to connecting people who have overdosed with treatment right away?
Yeah, so there's several pieces to that. One is information sharing so that we can finally get a wraparound service as to, like, how do we find these folks? How do we get to these folks? So it's enabling – some of that was an enabling legislation to data share and to get to those folks so that we can really do the kind of work we need to do to study this disease. Not that we don't know what it is. It's, you know, it's not a hard thing to figure out in some aspects. In other aspects, it is hard to figure out. But that legislation is you know, kind of opening up the ability for us to connect the dots to folks that have overdosed and try to trace them down and track them down and get help. The other pieces of this, and there's a lot of legislation and more to come, you know, stay tuned because we're not done yet with some of the things we need to do to make this happen. And I'm not afraid to say that I will be down there and working on this so that we can get people the help they need. But the overdose board, or I should say the system of care approach, is something that we use in the state for trauma. We use it for stroke and pediatrics. I happen to sit on all three committees. And in talking with the lieutenant governor and others, you know, it seemed to make sense. Like, why not get this going from one side of the state to the other and get all the right people at the table and collectively decide how we're going to do this? I mean, there's some folks out there, I'm not even going to lie, that are doing terrific work. They're doing fantastic things. And we've discovered that on our trips out. So I think bringing that all together and bringing everyone to the table and saying, hey, you know, so-and-so is doing this, 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 but let's do it collectively. So every ER has a game plan. You know, every transitional housing has a game plan. I spoke yesterday, I guess it was the day before, talking about, like, if you had a heart attack or stroke, everybody would know, from the EMS to the paramedics to the ER doc to the hospitalist taking care of you in the hospital. Everybody would know what you should be getting, what you should do, how you should be treated. And we already know the path you're going to take. We study it. We know it. We QA it. But we don't have that for a disease that's killing more people in our state right now than either one of those things.
So what pieces need to be put into place at specifically at ERs and other places like schools and prisons?
I mean, I could break it down step by step by step. And oh, my gosh, it's daunting. But even how EMS treats folks, you know, where do they go? Do they get Narcan and go to the ER, or do they get Narcan and go to treatment? Someplace which is a giddied up treatment center with a lot of resources, more than we have right now, to start them on their treatment straight away, you know, without that ER stop. My conception is as well that a lot of the stabilization centers, as we talk about them, could be a wing off the ED. It could be a wing somewhere else.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the stabilization centers are the state can now create those because of the legislation.
Exactly. So they didn't exist. It was a concept that no one even knew what it was. And I'm going to tell you, when we first started, everyone got a little freaky deaky because it was like, oh, you're going to take people that just you know, were pulled out of the jaws of death from overdosing, and you're just going to dump them in some place that's not a hospital? And everyone's like, what oh? And that is not what we're doing, and that is never what I would endorse or, you know. So the stabilizations are going to be much more giddied up than we have in the sense of folks that dispense medication and the like. But it's also going to be perhaps a wing off an ED or a wing off another facility so that if someone decompensates or we get hit with something that's different or new, they can slide back over to the ER and we can address that. But, you know, it's for imminently stable folks that in general they would overdose on a single substance, be revived at the house, be perfectly fine, and maybe at one point in time saying, I'm not going to the hospital for whatever reason. They hate hospitals. They hate needles. They hate ironically, they hate needles that don't have anything in them. But they hate the idea of being hospitalized, or they're afraid that they're going to get locked up there and won't get out, or the police will come and haul them away. So the whole idea is to remove that stigma for them sometimes and say, hey, you're perfectly fine, but let's get you help.
So it would be a more comfortable atmosphere.
I think it would be much more conducive to folks to consider it. Sometimes it may be, hey, just come with us and let us hook you up tonight with Suboxone. Let us hook you up tonight, you know, with methadone or whatever is appropriate for the particular place in their disease process. But people, I think, would be much more receptive to say, hey, we're gonna take you to treatment. We're going to get you help tonight. And not go the way of them thinking that the police are going to come in and, you know, they're going to get locked up and tied down and things that are, of course, not true, but that's what people think. You think the worst, right? Like, oh, I'm a heroin addict. Someone's going to lock my butt up and I'm going to get in trouble and this and that. That's not what's going to happen. And I think we're far away from that. So I think it may be more attractive, not only from the standpoint of a lot of them won't have to stay inpatient. A lot of them can just get hooked up in treatment so they don't go through withdrawal, because everybody knows that when you start feeling horrible and you feel like you have flu times 10, what do? You reach for something, right? You don't just sit and feel horrible. If you have the flu, you're like, oh, my gosh, where's the NyQuil? Where's the Motrin? Where's the Tylenol, right? But for a drug addict that's feeling sick and horrible because they're in withdrawal, they're not reaching for Motrin, Tylenol, or NyQuil. You know, they'll go back to heroin, which they know makes them feel better when they're drug sick. And that's like the horrible cycle. And that's what we got to break. And so, you know, seeing folks leave the hospital AMA over and over and over again because they get drug sick and it's not addressed just made me crazy, you know, like, hello, these people are leaving because they feel horrible. They feel like they got hit by a truck, plus they had the flu for 5 days before it. And so recognizing if we can get folks into treatment. And part of this is also getting the EDs considering doing medication-assisted treatment. We're not talking about having people stand in line and dispensing it every day, right? We are talking about someone who comes in crisis, they overdoses, they're not interested in going inpatient, but they are interested in not going through withdrawal and trying to stop from picking up again. So one dose, two at the most, until they can get into a stable medication-assisted daily treatment program like Brandywine Counseling has. But if you catch folks on a weekend, like on a Friday night or Saturday, they may not get to be intaked, you know, to get through the process to get Suboxone or methadone that very same day. So we need to offer them something to bridge them till they can get there. So it is my anticipation that in the very near future, we will be bridging folks to outpatient treatment with Suboxone for those that are qualified to do so. And that's another piece also, engaging folks right now on Fridays and Saturdays in my ED. I got my best buddy, Keith Pettifor, who is from Brandywine Counseling. He is my sidekick. He sits at my side, and the two of us work together to get folks into treatment. And in the short time that we've had it together, he's been 2 days a week so far, and we will be expanding that. But, you know, he has connected 17 people into treatment, and we follow them 2 weeks, 1 month, 6 weeks, 6 months, 3 months, 6 months. And so we're charting these folks out. We're making callbacks and getting folks to stay in treatment. And that's where we kind of feel like peer-to-peer stuff will come into play is, you know, we have a substance abuse counselor in the ED with me, like I said, Friday and Saturday nights, but we're going to expand that. And then peer-to-peer kind of folks, when I say peer, these are folks that have been there, walked the walk, and are in stable recovery and get it. They get what it's like to deal with this problem. So those are the folks that are going to help continue the engagement process with the folks that are that we've gotten in treatment. Like I said, we have 17. I have a happy spreadsheet, and you know, we have phone numbers and contacts, and we chart where we are with them. And then you know, we do it as well if they're inpatient. If they've been hospitalized, we'll go up to the room and do the same thing. So a lot of different things where peers can be actively involved in keeping people engaged and getting them to the next point in their journey, whether it's to show up for MAT or, you know, to show up for follow appointments or to stay, you know, in the right place. And then, you know, another piece which really is great is this online resource that's coming. Yes. So that any given time we can toggle the computer up and see how many beds are available at any given time.
In real time.
In
too,
real yeah. time, minute yeah. by minute. So nobody can play like hide the salami game with us as far as where a bed's available, because unfortunately beds
what,
are tight.
What is bed availability like? I was going to ask you that. I mean, you're working on connecting people with treatment. Are all the resources for treatment there in the state, or do we have work to do on that as well?
I think we can do better. And I think we will do better. We need to do better by these folks. You know, it affects everyone. And I get tired of saying that. It's somebody's brother. It's your uncle. It's somebody. We got to do better by these folks, you know. So I think right now the resources are tight, to say the least. And we don't have room. If every single person that is struggling with substance use disorder, even if you were a heroin addict, if every single heroin addict today wanted to go into inpatient treatment, we could not accommodate them. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen. But we anticipate there will be a day that there'll be a slot for everyone who's ready in some form or fashion. It may be transitional housing, sober living. It may be MAT. It may be a shorter rehab stay than traditional. It may be a stabilization center transitioning to MAT. But there will be a way. And the only way you can do this is get all the players at the table and say, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're asking of you. Are you on? Are you coming with me? Or do I have to step over you? You know, like, that's where we're at with this. And Lieutenant Governor is not playing. You know what I mean? Like, she is entrusted with this mission, and she does not fail. And so I just kind of hang on to her cape and go in the direction that we need to go. And I really think the path is becoming more and more clear as we find out what people need and we find out what we don't have and what we need to have. I mean, I'm not here to tell you that this is going to be solved tomorrow. It may not be solved in 6 months, but we're going to stay with it until we do have a tangible path. So when Sandy Gibney overdoses, she doesn't get Narcan and goes home, right? So Sandy Gibney knows exactly where she's going from point A to back to my life and get my life back. And I feel like if I feel comfortable navigating the system for a loved one, then it'll be okay for everyone else. And I'm not at that point right now.
Thanks to St. Francis Hospital's Dr. Sandra Gibney and Arnick Shalino for their time on The Green this week. And stick around. We'll tell you more about this Tuesday's Kent County Economic Summit in Dover. That's next on The Green, after a check of your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The annual Kent County Economic Summit is fast approaching. This year's event is Tuesday, September 18th at Deltek's Terry Campus in Dover and will focus on digital transformation in business. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele spoke with Deltek's Lisa Strazowski and Cornelia Johnson about the summit to get a preview of what to expect from the various panelists and guest speakers.
All right, we're talking today about the Kent County Economic Summit to address digital transformation in business. It's coming up in Dover. And to get us started and talk about it, we've got Lisa Strazowski. She's the Director of Workforce Development and Community Education. It's the division that puts the summit together. Lisa, welcome. Tell me all about the summit, if you will.
Oh, thank you for having us share today about the Kent County Economic Summit. We're very excited to have this event again. It's the 10th annual year for this event. It will be held on Tuesday, September 18th, starting at 7:15. Breakfast and lunch will be served, and it runs until 1 p.m. The location is at the Delaware Tech Terry Campus at the Del One Conference Center. And the summit has 300 plus attendees. We have exhibitors, vendors, we have key business, community, and government leaders that attend the event to network, and we showcase topics related to economic development in the state and county. So each year we have a different theme related to the summit, and this year the theme is the digital transformation in business. So we're going to share examples and information on how businesses can utilize technology to drive change and grow in their business in the areas of strategic planning, employee training and development, marketing and sales, and operations. So we're excited to have this event again at the Terry Campus at Delaware Tech, and it is a collaboration between the college, Delaware Tech, and the Central Delaware Business and Entrepreneurship Consortium.
Why is this so important now? I mean, it's 2018, and you said the conference is going to focus on the digital transformation in business. This is more important now than ever, right?
Absolutely. So we got together and determined that this was a theme that would translate to all businesses, particularly small business owners, up to large business corporations and any size in between, to learn how to take the topics that the panelists and the speakers are going to talk to and apply it to their business so they can grow their business, integrate technology into their business, whether it's through marketing and social media or if they can do it through training and development with their employees and finding ways to do that electronically versus paper and just a whole host of areas. So we have four executives on the panel who come from various industries. So, and regardless of the industry, everything that they talk about will translate perfectly to any type of business that or community partner that attends the event.
Talk about, besides the panel discussions, there's going to be keynote speakers. Talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. We are so pleased to have Mike Quaranta, the president of the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, deliver the keynote address. Michael has tremendous amount of experience in both government and the private sector, which relates well to our summit audience. And he was just recently named the chamber president, as you know, so this is the first time many of our summit attendees will have the opportunity to hear from him. And Mike is going to share the state's economic outlook. So he's going to look at the macro level. And then Linda Parkowski, the executive director of Kent County Economic Partnership, will share insight on the economic outlook of Kent County, so more at the micro level. So there's certainly lots of changes and developments taking place in the state of Delaware, as you know, and the keynotes will address those changes and those new economic development initiatives.
For attendees, what do you expect the takeaway will be for people attending?
So the attendees will learn, there's a couple of things. They will get to network extensively. We always build in plenty of time for them to network with each other, meet with the vendors. So we have anywhere from 25 to 35 vendors each year. This year we're definitely over the 30 vendor mark. So they can meet with vendors to help them with their business, share ideas. But they'll also hear these interesting topics and take back the information to their business about digitally transforming their business in operations and marketing and sales and strategic planning so they can build their business plans according to the 21st century and the changes that are occurring in our economy and our marketplace.
All right. Is it too late to sign up for this event?
Absolutely not. We have a website. So if you go on the web and just type in Kent County Economic Summit, Delaware Tech, it'll come right up. And or you can go to DTCC, that's dtcc.edu/economic summit. Or they can call us at 302-857-1400 to register, which is $35 for an individual registration. We have exhibitor tables still available. They start at $100, and a ticket is provided with that. And we have various levels of sponsorship. We have an event sponsor at $250, major sponsor at $500, and a platinum sponsor at $750. And at each level, it's listed on the website. You can find out more information about how you will exhibit and the promotion for your business. Because we do have a lot of information on the website at dtcc.edu/economic summit. To find out more information, certainly get in touch with us. We can talk to you about it. We have staff that is readily available to take the information to register, or you can register online.
That's great. We're talking to Lisa Struzowski. She's the Director of Workforce Development and Community Education. It's the division that puts the summit together, the Kent County Economic Summit, which is going to be held on September the 18th. Want to flip gears a second and go over to Cornelia Johnson. Cornelia is the recently appointed Campus Director for Dell Tech. Cornelia, thank you so much for joining the conversation today. What does this mean for Dell Tech to host this Kent County Economic Summit?
First, Delaware Tech is very pleased to be able to host the summit. We embrace the opportunity to help present on such a relevant topic. And being an educational institution that provides academic and workforce training for the state of Delaware, I think that it is... It just provides a great setting for people of our state to come and learn about such an important topic.
Yeah, definitely centrally located. I mean, you're going to get people from upstate, you're going to get people from Kent County, you're going to get people from downstate. So that's in its favor, and it's at Dell Tech's Terry campus, and you can showcase the college during the summit as well.
Absolutely. And so we're happy to host it, and we will provide that opportunity for individuals who are at the conference to see some of the other things that we do have on our campus. Again, we have workforce training as well as academic programs. So,
Cornelia, is there anything else that you want to add? You were listening to our conversation. Anything else you can add to this?
I think the most important thing that we want to add is that we're always open for collaborating to provide opportunities for individuals to come onto our campus, but also to provide information, education to our community.
Thanks to Delaware Tech's Lisa Struzowski and Cornelia Johnson and R. Kelly Steele for their time this week. You can find out more about the Kent County Economic Summit, including how to register, at Delaware Tech's website, dtcc.edu. And Kelly Steele rejoins us in just a moment with the latest edition of Arts Playlist, where we meet a local jewelry maker and designer with a national reputation. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Noted Delaware jewelry maker and designer Olga Gonatis was this year's featured artist at last weekend's 2018 Brandywine Festival of the Arts. Gonatis has been making jewelry primarily in silver for the past 30 years. She's built a national reputation for her work, which includes being tapped as the licensed jewelry designer and maker for HBO's Game of Thrones television series. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele speaks with Gonatis about her career and the opportunity to design jewelry for not one, but two major television shows.
They usually pick an artist each year that they want to celebrate, embrace, advertise, and they'd like to give them credit for their years of work in the arts.
How long have you been making jewelry? Take me back and, you know, walk me through how you design jewelry.
Started making jewelry about over 30 years ago. went to the Philadelphia College of Art, fell in love with working with metals, and really got into different textures. That's what I really try to explore, are the textures in metals and combining the different metals, sometimes combining silver with silver, sometimes combining a copper and silver, different stones, pearls.
Olga, have you, has the style of jewelry over the years changed that you've noticed?
Well, I think styles always change. As far as the style of jewelry, sure. I'm not going to keep making the same thing over and over again. Sometimes long earrings are happening. Sometimes short ones are happening. Sometimes pearls are really hot. Sometimes pearls on leather are really hot. You know, I make what I like to make. Sometimes I follow the trends, and sometimes I don't. I've been making cuff bracelets, oh gosh, for about 30 years, and I still continue to make them.
Now, here's something exciting, and it interests me because it was one of my favorite shows on TV. We're talking about Lost.
It's a fun show.
You were introduced to network executives of Lost, who eventually asked you to create a line of jewelry linked to that show's theme. Talk about that a little bit. That sounds very exciting.
That was exciting. That it just so happens that I was a big fan of the show. I just absolutely loved the show, and I was having lunch with a friend of mine in New York City, and her brother wrote the music for the show.
Well,
so I said, if I was stranded on the island, what would I do? And I would be like, I would probably, you know, make jewelry, and she was saying what she would do. And so the long and short of it was they were going to a party in L.A. They asked me to make some jewelry. I did for her and her brother, and ABC saw it. It happened to some of the people were there at the party, and one thing led to another. It wasn't even something that I was looking for, which I always find very interesting. I wasn't like thinking, oh, I want to make jewelry for the TV show Lost. I want to make jewelry for a TV show Game of Thrones. I didn't even go looking for any of that. It fell into my lap, and I just started making some things for the ABC website. And what is interesting about all these TV shows is that they always have products that are related to the shows, so that people can have a part of the show, whether it be a mug, a T-shirt, a piece of jewelry, a paperweight, and that's how pop culture works.
Wow. So Lost ended its run. I was sad to see that because, again, it was one of my shows.
Too.
Lost ended its run in 2010, and then you were approached by HBO executives about creating a jewelry line for Game of Thrones? Seriously?
Yeah, that was also when Lost ended. I thought, okay, that's it. You know, TV's gone, focusing on my jewelry. And then I guess it was about 3 years later, the product developer from HBO called me and said, we liked what you did for Lost. We have a new show coming out, Game of Thrones. We'd like for you to, can you make some things for us? And it's very structured. It's very, they know what they want. It's related to the show. There's a lot of ins and outs. There's a lot of legality that goes on with that. And so we gave it a whirl. And one of the most popular items that I ended up making was a box that had the three dragon eggs in there, which actually, the idea actually came from the Warner Brothers people in France, and they wanted me to make that, and that's how that one came about, which was really interesting. It ended up being our bestseller, still is to this day.
This is just all very fascinating. This is all just very fascinating to me. I don't think I've ever met anyone that has designed jewelry for TV shows, around TV shows.
Well, I don't think I have either. And I think it was interesting that you design things that they're the actors, and it's not actually on the show. It's all inspired from the show. And it's so that everybody can have a piece of the show, and they'd like to have products relating to the show. Everything is sold on the HBO website or Entertainment Earth or Diamond Comics. There's all these big pop culture companies that I didn't even know about. I was used to dealing with galleries and doing shows, but which also then led me to doing New York Comic Con, which was also a real trip.
I'm sure it was. Comic Cons around the country are very popular nowadays.
They're crazy. It's like Halloween 4 days a week.
All right. So will you be selling or showing any new design of jewelry that you want to let people know about?
Well, I've really explored textures, and I will definitely be showing a lot of new work that has a lot of organic type textures on them.
Do you have a website that you can send people to that they can see your stuff, buy your stuff?
They can go right to olgaganatis.com, which will lead them to a shopping site.
Anything else about your jewelry that you want people to know about?
I think that the work speaks for itself. It's a lot of fun to wear. You can dress up the jewelry, dress down the jewelry, wear it every day, collect it, enjoy it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's a big thing nowadays. I think people want jewelry that they can wear every day. That's not just, you know, a special occasion piece, but rather they can wear to work or they can wear to school.
Right.
Thanks to Olga Gonatis and our Kelly Steele for their time on this week's Arts Playlist. And if you want to check out Gonatis' jewelry, you can find a link to it at DelawarePublic.org. The Green concludes next with Enlighten Me, and a trip to Washington, D.C. to learn more about the Lenape tribe's roots in the first state. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Lenape tribal citizens and community members recently had their first opportunity to explore the National Museum of American Indians Cultural Resources Center. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt joined them in Washington, D.C., and has more on what they learned in this week's Enlighten Me.
That was one of our plans.
At the Cultural Resources Center, located just outside of Washington, D.C., the group that included Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware Chief Dennis Coker saw fishing nets like those their ancestors made. Cultural Resources staff pulled a variety of mid-Atlantic region nets, fikes, and eel traps out of storage. Most were made around the late 19th or early 20th centuries and were attributed as nanocoke. The Delaware contingent was led by University of Delaware student Annabel Fitchner, who visited the repository for research. In addition to studying art conservation and anthropology at UD, she's an intern with the Lenape Tribe's Cultural Mapping Project. Fitchner's undergraduate thesis probes two questions.
How fishing nets were traditionally made among mid-Atlantic tribes in general, and then how this knowledge can then be spread and revived within contemporary Native communities.
Cultural Mapping Project Manager Ruth Ann Purchase gave Fitchner the idea for the net project and notes the significance of water and fish for the Lenape.
Being on the Delmarva Peninsula, water was their life. They had to cross the peninsula by water, and the sturgeon was like 20-some feet long and gave all this caviar, and the shad was so full that they say you could walk across the Brandywine River on the backs of the fish when they came up to breathe.
Chief Coker says identifying these materials and how they were made shows how resourceful the Lenape were and serves to build awareness.
It's almost like it's awakening and awareness that was ingrained in our DNA for forever.
According to Fitchner, at least two of the net-related objects the group saw were Lenape. She says a wooden shuttle used to weave nets and a wooden net float were documented elsewhere by 20th century anthropologist C.A. Westlager as made by Lenape fisherman Clem Carney. Lenape tribal citizen Melody Klein came on the trip with her husband and three children. Clem Carney was her sixth great cousin. She says she didn't expect to see objects made by him on the trip.
Those are the first that I've seen. Yeah, that's amazing. It's really gives me goosebumps.
The net-making shuttle and net float were labeled as nanocoke. Fitchner explains this kind of misattribution is common.
These anthropologists would come and sort of take the train through these communities and not necessarily recognize that one was different from the other.
During the trip, Fitchner filed paperwork suggesting that the object's documentation be changed to reflect a Lenape origin. The nets the group looked at were nearly all made of cotton, but Fitchner and Cultural Resources staff did find two individual knots of cordage, which is similar to twine made from native plants. Textile conservation fellow Noral Frankel identified these as likely made of dog bane. Frankel gave 7-year-old Charlotte Klein a lesson in natural fiber spinning.
Today was really fun because I got to learn about fiber and other stuff that is really cool, like wooden stuff that was from a long, long time ago.
Chief Coker has spoken about the difficulty of getting Lenape youth involved with their culture, but the group visiting the Cultural Resources Center included 3 kids. While Fitchner aims to teach Lenape community members to weave traditional nets, Coker notes that he doesn't see tribal citizens beginning to weave nets for subsistence fishing again.
You never know where those practices may lead you. If it's nothing but making you aware of a higher order of things, you know, a spiritual connection and giving thanks for all of this that we have.
Cultural Resources staff honored the Lenape visitors with a homemade lunch, and Purchase notes the seeds of future partnerships were planted.
Having these interns from the universities work with our tribal citizens just opens so many doors in every direction.
Maria Martinez works in collections management at the Cultural Resources Center. She says the center gets visits from tribal leaders like Chief Coker about weekly, and visits from Native constituents help staff identify and learn about the full context of the objects they take care of. Martinez says roughly 40% of visitors to the center are Native and 60% non-Native. She'd like to see that ratio flipped, and says that boils down to outreach.
We welcome Native people. This is who we serve, and this is what our purpose is. The National Museum of the American Indian is here for our Native constituents.
Chief Coker agrees that participation and leadership by Indigenous people is essential to conservation and research using their materials.
I'm excited that our community is involved in this research. It's just not, you know, non-Native people that are interested in who and what we are. I think this is really just the beginning.
Fitchner's research project culminates this spring with public workshops catering to Delaware's Lenape community, where she'll talk about traditional cordage materials and patterns and offer hands-on lessons in net making. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia, for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.